When I was looking for a source for an idea for the sermon, I found it in an unlikely spot, or I remembered that I had found it in an unlikely spot. It is the first sermon that I have ever preached out of the traditional Bowhunter magazine. I'm not going to preach the whole sermon. I'm just going to use it for the introduction. I only read two magazines cover to cover, the regular magazines, and one is Traditional Bowhunter and the other is Primitive Archer. This one was an article by a guy named Monty Browning, and I've read his stuff for years. He's a good writer. It's called Alaskan Grubstake Bow Hunt, 50 Years Later. Now, grubstake bow hunt means that you pack all your gear in and you stay for a couple weeks and hunt. You know, you don't have motorized vehicles. They got dropped off by a plane because they're way in the backcountry. And it was up on the little delta area of Alaska, where 50 years ago, 1958, 51 years ago now, two of the most famous bow hunters in America, which probably don't mean anything to any of you except for those who are archers, but Fred Bear was one of them. Glenn St. Charles, you probably never heard of, but I know who he is. I've met him. They went up there and hunted caribou and moose. Monty Browning, when he was a very young man in his 20s, was there too. It was a rare item. Fred Bear is the Fred Bear Bow Company that still is in existence and really made archery popular in America through the 1940s and 50s and 60s and 70s and 80s and 90s and aughts. Huge impact on the sport. Interestingly, Fred Bear made five companions with him, and he made five special bows. He made them himself. Laminated fiberglass bows, used turquoise fiberglass for the job, and gave them to each of his five friends who were on that hunt. So Monty Browning would have gotten one of those. Those bows are worth thousands of dollars as collector's items. Ironically, about 2 years ago, Glenn White, who pastors in Montana and who's a very close friend of mine and also a fellow archer, we were out killing time one afternoon, and we went to a couple of, sporting goods stores. And this one place is in Delaware, but it isn't much of a store. It's more used stuff. And wouldn't you know it, this guy was a collector of Fred Bear bows, and he had one of the little Delta commemorative bows. At the time, it was only worth about $5,000. Not only did he have it, he strung it up and let us pull it, which for us, that was a big deal, I don't know why I bore you with that. It wouldn't be a big deal to you, but there was a historic experience in that area. So Monty Browning was one of the young fellows on that particular trip. Fred Bear was older at the time. Interestingly, he's a Christian type guy. He's a part of a group called Christian Bow Hunters of America. So he took another close friend of his on this hunt. They're both in their early 70s, but very fit, tall, strong, very fit men. You can tell from the pictures in the article. And they've been hunting to give you an idea of how they did it, they flew over the area they wanted to hunt. It was upriver from where their pilot could land, 6 miles upriver. They decided that was a good place where there would be moose and possibly caribou. So they dumped their raft out of the airplane, and it bounced on the rocks. And then they went back down 6 miles downriver, and that's where he landed and dropped them off, and they packed their gear 6 miles, took two trips. And they were, under phenomenal loads, probably 80 or 90 pound packs, because they were going to be there for 2 or 3 weeks. They got up there, and it wasn't but a couple days later, a big, huge record book caribou walked into their camp, so his buddy got that with his bow and arrow. Then a bear came, because it was following the smell of the caribou, offal. It was a really, really big grizzly bear that kept plaguing them the rest of the time they were there. They started hunting moose, and they went for days and couldn't find the moose. As it turned out, the story here. The caribou moved their migration a little bit, so they, instead of going south or north of this particular basin, they were coming right through it. They come up over the mountain, drop down into the basin, which is where they were camped and hunting, go right through this thick, nasty, brushy woods, and up over the next mountain. When caribou get ready to move, they just go. Rivers don't stop them. They swim. And it doesn't matter, whatever it was, if that's where they decide they want to migrate, that's where they go. Well, that was scaring the moose out of the basin because they'd hear these caribou coming through the brush and they didn't know if it was caribou or if it was a bear. So then they all shifted. So there weren't any moose, and this was supposed to be a moose-heavy area. So it was time to ask for a little help. He said, we're both strong believers in the power of prayer, and while I almost never ask for physical gifts for myself, and this was a sentence that caught my eye, while I almost never ask for physical gifts for myself, I do ask for guidance and direction and protection. I had asked for guidance. Now, stop and go back. I've got two more sentences. I told you basically the story. He did get a really big moose. They both about lost their lives floating all that moose meat and caribou meat downriver to the landing area. The strainers kept pulling them off of the raft and going under, and they got a leak. And it's amazing, really, that they survived. But you know, one of them, his buddy, grabbed the strainer to try to fish Monty Browning out of the water, and it wrenched his shoulder back, and to where the last 2 days of their trip, his arm just hung at his side in intense pain. So you can see that they had a challenge, but they survived and they got home. But he couldn't find a moose, and that was the whole point of this hunt, was to try to get a moose in this area that he had hunted 50 years earlier. And he asked for guidance, and that's what he didn't ask for gifts for himself. How often do we, when we pray, you know, ask, well, I need this and I want that and give me this, and sort of the gimme list, you know. It's a good lesson on the power of prayer and what to focus our prayers on. Well, they went after the moose, and you know, they're in the thick brush where you've got caribou and you've got bull moose, and bull moose can be on the cantankerous side periodically, and if they want to be cantankerous, they're capable because they weigh about 1,700 pounds. And they get big headgear on. And then they had bears in there too. So stalking in that jungle was out of the question. Calling seemed our only chance. Bob would try to coax the bulls out of their sanctuary. I would try to work the wind and stalk in for the shot. We packed our gear, bowed our heads, and asked God for wisdom and guidance. Now, there's another element. We asked, first of all, for guidance and protection, and now he's asking for wisdom and for guidance. And I thought, there's a sermon in that. They got the bull, and as we approached the big bull, we were both stunned. It was huge. It was really huge. We were both stunned at how big it was, and we dropped to our knees in thanks to our God, our Creator, for the gift and for the guidance. So, the title of the sermon is, drawing a lesson from Monty Browning, this traditional bow hunter. By traditional bow hunter, I mean, it's a bow. It has a string and it shoots arrows. It has no pulleys, it has no cables, and it isn't mounted on a rifle stock sitting sideways. This is the real deal. Archery, that's why they call it traditional archery in that sense. Anyway, the title of the sermon is Pray for Wisdom, Guidance, and Protection. Like I said, it isn't often you find a sermon in an archery magazine, but in those few sentences, there is one. It's good advice. You know, he specifically didn't just ask for physical gifts. You know, send me the biggest, you know, bull moose you can find in this part of Alaska and let it come right up and stand there while I shoot it with my arrow. They didn't ask for that. He asked for wisdom and for guidance and for protection. They needed all those things. And I think its approach and the wisdom of that approach is something that we need to consider in our prayers, especially considering our present distress in the end time of history that we live in. Now, first of all, let's size up our times a bit. Let's go to 2 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 1. Let's look at what we're living in today. You heard about the tragic news and the evil news, because there was evil involved in it, of the massacre of the soldiers down at Fort Hood in Texas yesterday. The nation is in a serious peril. Not just this nation, though, the whole world is, quite frankly. 2 Timothy chapter 3, the Apostle Paul forewarned. He lived in a time of peril and jeopardy as well. And I suppose in a general sense it applies to any time in history. But Paul gave a prophecy. He was an apostle, but he was also a prophet. But know this, this is verse 1 of 2 Timothy 3, but know this, that in the last days, perilous times will come. Perilous, we use synonymously with dangerous. Technically, the Greek says times of stress will come. Times of stress. Dangerous times of stress. So let's look at some of the hallmarks, just very briefly. We'll survey them, and you can analyze, as we do that, what we see around us. Men will be lovers of themselves. Now, it says that in another place we'll see that because iniquity shall abound, the love of many will wax cold. Well, there is one love that isn't going to wax cold. It's the love of self. Selfish concern. That doesn't wax cold at all. It gets hotter all the time. Lovers of money. That's probably part of the reason why we have the economic straits we're in right now. Because of those who were so greedy of money. Boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy people, unloving, unforgiving, slanderers, without self-control, brutal. Saw that brutal yesterday. Despisers of good. Traitors. You could probably make the case you saw that yesterday too. Headstrong, haughty, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. Having a form of godliness, man is made in the image of God, but denying the power thereof. It's the dangerous, crazy world we live in. And you know, you could see that and you could say, yeah, that's just all around. But how does that really apply to us? What makes it germane to America? Well, Jeremiah makes it germane to America. Jeremiah chapter 30. It's another ominous prophecy. Now, I don't want to be preoccupied with the ominosity of it all, but these are our times that we live in, and we need wisdom, and we need guidance, and we need protection. And we go to God to get them. There's going to be a time that Jeremiah was inspired to write, and this is God giving the prophecy through Jeremiah. For thus says the Lord in verse 5, we have heard the voice of trembling, of fear and not of peace. Ask now and see whether a man is ever in labor with a child. So why do I see every man with his hands on his loins like a woman in labor and all faces turn pale? You know, the labor pains of childbirth are very intense, and men don't have to go through them. So this is why it's such a remarkable description, that the pain, but it's a pain of a different kind, really. It's a pain of stress, of danger, and fear. I don't think we're seeing that quite yet. Now, we have troubles on the horizon. You know, what is Iran going to do when it gets its nuclear weapons? And they've got the ability to deliver them. They've got advanced Scud missiles, much worse than the first Persian Gulf War, much more effective. They got them from North Korea, which has been testing them. And now they've got very long-range missiles themselves. So what will happen when either North Korea both of them, and Iran end up with nuclear weapons that they can deliver to their enemies? And we haven't even touched on China, nor have we touched on the sleeping giant that, if you've been paying any attention at all to European news in the past few weeks, past couple of months actually, since America's illustrious president withdrew the nuclear shield from Romania, or from Poland, which infuriated the Polish, but what could they do about it? They're only the Poles. But it was like a hand writing on the wall for the Europeans. Uh-oh. Russia is flexing her muscles. She's doing major military exercises in the backside of Estonia and Latvia right now. They started this past week. That'll probably last for several weeks. And they do their military exercises, but what they're doing is they're trying to rebuild their superpower status that they had when they were the Soviet Union. They're powerful. And Europe has nothing of significance, and they know it. Europe is dependent upon America to be their shield. And America had just broadcasted to them in the most, obvious way that we don't really care about you. That's why we're taking this nuclear shield, this early warning system and, weapons array that they had established in Poland under the previous administration. They were just unilaterally yanked out. Now, they put up some paltry version of that. The vice president announced a couple of weeks ago in Romania, but too little and too late. Europe now knows that they have to do something. Now, we know in history they're going to do something. They are the area of the ancient Roman Empire and is going to rise again. So that's happening. And we see America backing away, and America has been the leading nation descended from the tribes of Jacob, or the tribes of Israel, and going way back into ancient history. In verse 7, it says this, "Alas, alas, for that day is great, so that none is like it. And it is the time of Jacob's trouble." Now, that's a prophecy for modern times. So when it says Jacob's trouble, you have to know who the descendants of Jacob are in the modern world. Most people vacantly assume it's just the Jews. In fact, most Jewish people think the same thing. But the Jews were only two tribes, Judah and Benjamin. Not all of Benjamin. Frankly, not all of Judah. There were bits and pieces that were extracted from them back in 700 AD or BC, and a little bit of Levi mixed in. So it is a time of Jacob's trouble. Now, I think we can make the case, looking at the dominant nations descended from Jacob, whose name was changed to Israel by God, and that would be the United States and Britain, certainly, Scandinavia and Northern Ireland and France and such, we can see that they're facing troubles of various kinds, but America, being the superpower, one of the lot, is facing much more difficult times than the others. You know, we're teetering on an economic collapse, potential collapse. It may be mitigated to some degree, but we are seeing the same remedies used in the Great Depression with no effect being used now. Economic stimuluses. Franklin Roosevelt used 4 or 5 economic stimuluses during the 1930s, and it would bump the stock market up for several months. It was just enough to get a little momentum so it could take another flying leap off the cliff, and down it would go. And it was up and down, up and down, up and down. Finally, one strategy brought it out. It brought the economy back and killed off the depression. But that economic strategy is not one we want. World War II. Except it wouldn't be World War II this time. Because this is the next one. It would be World War III. We see a time of Jacob's trouble. Now, we haven't been dramatically affected by it, but the newspaper reported today that officially unemployment has hit 10.2% in the U.S., officially. The cooked books suspicions of the particular administration is running America today make a lot of the more conservative thinking economists think that it's higher by far than that. 15, 16, maybe 17% in effect, in practical effect. But it officially is listed at 10.2% unemployment. We've seen this before. We know where these trends end up going. We've seen recessions before. And we've also, as I said, we've seen a Great Depression. So we are in a time of Jacob's trouble. I think we're in the beginnings of the serious element of that time, but we're in it. Now the good news is, lest we morose ourselves to depression, personally, is the end of verse 7, but he shall be saved out of it. Not all of him, but part of him. And it shall come to pass in that day, says the Lord of hosts, that I will break his yoke from your neck and burst your bonds, and foreigners will no more enslave them, and they will serve the Lord their God and David their king, who I will raise up for them. That's a prophecy of the millennial rule of Jesus Christ. And that's when they're saved out of it. But it is only a remnant that's saved. We are headed down for the count. Now, let's look at some of the other indicators of this time of Jacob's trouble and these perilous times in which we live. Let's go to Isaiah this time, chapter 3. Isaiah chapter 3, just the whole chapter is jam-packed with it, but we'll just pick one bit. Verses 8 and 9. And here is a reference to Jerusalem stumbled and Judah is fallen. That's how verse 8 of Isaiah chapter 3 begins. For Jerusalem stumbled and Judah is fallen. Now, Jerusalem being involved in this prophecy indicates more than Judah. And the fact that they're tied together, that you're getting the capital of what was once the capital of all the 12 tribes, and then Judah, which ended up being the capital later of Judah. Jerusalem here has an application in a general way to all the tribes of Israel and all the nations who descended from those tribes. Because their tongue and their doings are against the Lord. Their tongue, their language, and their behavior are against the Eternal, to provoke the eyes of His glory. In other words, what they say and what they do is in violation of the way of life that God said for them to live. The look on their countenance, which means their face, witnesses against them. I don't know, some people, I think, sort of stagger through life and never, ever learn to read faces. But other people seem to have been born with the ability to read faces. And if they're, a risky lot, they end up making money as gamblers because they can read people. We should all learn to read people because our faces witness against us. You can try to hide what you're thinking. Or what you're feeling, more what you feel than you think sometimes. But body language makes it clear. I had a next door neighbor in Oregon who was a city policeman. And we got to be pretty good friends. And one day, what did he need? We were driving downtown for something. And maybe we were going to go get pizza and have dinner at one house or the other. It was some errand we were on for our wives. And I'm driving along and we're chattering and all of a sudden his head snaps back. And I said, "What'd you see?" He said, "That guy back there, he's high." I said, "How can you tell that?" Oh, he said, "Well, you didn't see the way he was moving his feet when he was walking and his head was bobbing like this." He starts describing all the symptoms of body language that he picked up on. And he said, "He's probably on thus and such." And I said, "Okay, I can see the body language. How do you know what he's high on?" He says, "Well, that's what he was high on last time I picked him up." But, obviously, they're trained to read body language. He ended up being involved in riot control. I don't know if you ever heard of the anarchist movement, but every time the World Trade Organization has a meeting, they have huge demonstrations that's driven by the anarchist movement. The think tank that drives the anarchist movement is in Eugene, Oregon, in the University of Oregon, according to law enforcement officials. And when they were getting started, the anarchist movement got started. They started in Eugene, and they started having a big riot and shut down the downtown of Eugene. It's not a huge city, but 250,000, and they started breaking windows and wrecking vehicles. And some guy made the mistake of jumping on the hood of a pickup. And the guy who owned the pickup happened to be in it. And he got out and grabbed the first thing handy, which was a ball peen hammer. And he bopped this guy right on the top of the head. And, you know, he started screaming. He was bleeding. It didn't hurt him that bad. It just started bleeding. And he screamed for the police to come. Let me explain. This is an anarchist movement. He's an anarchist. And so he's calling for the police. Sorry, they don't help you. You're an anarchist. Oh, it was one of the funniest things. Anyway, my neighbor got injured in the riot as it proceeded through the town. The police weren't up to riot standard yet at that time. They didn't know how to deal with riots. And he was busy. The one thing they did do is they do videotapes of what was going on. They study the videotapes later in the day, and the next day they go start arresting people because they had the evidence on the video. Well, he was running the camera and got hit with a huge stone right on the point of his shoulder, which actually kept him off work and almost broke his shoulder and damaged the ligaments and tendons severely. So he was off work for a couple of weeks from that. Then they started going to riot control. And the study of body language and how people's countenance witnesses against them. And they, if you want to know how they do that, they have their, it's just like a coach in a football team with the police, and somebody is the spotter. He's looking for the ringleaders of the riot. And when they identify them, then he calls the play. And the police are in their gear, they got their helmets on, they got their shields up. And he calls out the target, and they charge right at that part of the riot crowd where the ringleader is. They break through the crowd, grab him, yank him back behind their lines, and then they'll have another part of the team grabs him, and they just physically, they don't give him a chance to do anything. They're cuffing him, and they're dragging him, and he's shoved into a paddy wagon, and he's gone. Then they look for the next one. And you got your coaches calling the plays and sending the police in, just like football players, and grab, instead of sacking the quarterback, they're sacking the ringleaders. Haul them away, then they can't keep stirring up the crowd. That's effective. You see, the body language of the ringleaders witnesses against them. Likewise, in our country, the look on the face of the too many in the population witnesses against them, and they declare their sin as Sodom. Now you go back and read about Sodom and Gomorrah, you know what's being talked about there. And they do not hide it. Woe to their soul, for they have brought evil upon themselves. Hello, America. You're inheriting what you've been investing in for far too long. Now, that's a part of Jacob's trouble. Moral corruption, moral disintegration, on a huge percentage of the population. There's still a remnant that's trying to hold out. Let's go to Matthew 24. We get just a little bit more of looking before we get into what, you know, how to pray for wisdom and guidance and protection. We need to know clearly why we need God's wisdom, God's guidance, and God's protection. Matthew 24 is an end time prophecy for our day today. It has parallels. We'll actually go to one of those in a moment in Mark and Luke. But we'll look at Matthew 24 first. The disciples went to Jesus. They were on the Mount of Olives, which is across the canyon from the Temple Mount, where the Dome of the Rock is today and where the Alaska Mosque is today. And that's where there was a huge and bloody riot in Israel last week. An Israeli police established a much firmer presence. You see, they have allowed the Islamic police to police the Temple Mount. But there are enough religious zealot Jews. And I've always thought that the jihadists need to beware, because the Jewish people can be just as fanatical or worse than them. But anyway, we'll see that happen. There's going to be a showdown eventually there that's prophesied. So they apparently are making a stronger Israeli presence on the Temple Mount by far than they have exerted, although they could exert it if they wanted to. But they haven't until they began recently, just in the past, since the Feast of Tabernacles. All right, so he's up there, and the disciples say, we want to know what are the signs of your coming? And the end of the age, that's at the end of verse 3, the end of the age. Well, okay, now we're approaching the end of this age, and Jesus said, all right, this is what you got to watch out for. Take heed that nobody deceives you. There's going to be deception, deception, deception. If you're a sucker for every ad campaign that comes down the pike and you just got to have whatever they sell you, then beware. You need wisdom. You need wisdom, seriously. Because there's going to be serious deception being foisted off. We see it and have seen it ongoing. It is intensifying dramatically, even within the government and within the national core of America, which is where we have to live. Our brethren elsewhere will have to read these and apply them in their circumstances there. But deception is a big part of the game. And many will come in my name, saying, I am the Christ, either that Christ is the Christ or that they themselves are the Christ, and will deceive many. So you have false religion, you have deception in general, layer upon layer upon layer, and it's more and more effective, and people are more and more gullible and stupid and suck up and become suckers to where they just will accept it blindly. And you will hear wars and rumors of wars. Oh, hold it. Now this is another thing. All right, we've got religious deception, regular deception, increasing in intensity, and wars and rumors of wars. Well, we're kind of in that boat now. You know, we have Afghanistan and Iraq going on. Russians have been fighting with the Georgians and put the quietus to some of that, but it isn't always quiet. And then the rumors of wars. That's the saber rattling. What the Soviets are doing right now. What the Chinese are doing, you know, as well in their practices, and frankly, it's what America is doing in Israel today. 1,500 American generals and soldiers landed in Israel last week for they have annual military exercises where they go over things. You know, we've been allies for a long time now, and they plan and they strategize and they go through what they would have to do in case this happened or in case that happened. But the difference, it's no news that they do that. They do it every year. But the news is that we never ever sent anywhere near 1,500 men over there. That's how many are there today or got there yesterday or the day before. It's just in the news, just this past week. Fresh. Rumors of wars. See that you're not troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end isn't yet. This is, okay, we're not at the end yet. We're at the beginning of the end someplace, but we're not at the end yet. The nation's going to rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom, and there will be famines and pestilences and earthquakes in various places. All right, earthquakes are just popping up everywhere the past 2 or 3 weeks. I don't know if you've noticed that. We had one in Tennessee yesterday. Now, it wasn't a bad one, thankfully, but how often does Tennessee serve as the epicenter of an earthquake? Not very often. Famines, pestilences. Well, so far, Super Wall has plenty of food. So far. Pestilences. Well, we've got the swine flu epidemic, which is almost as bad as a regular flu epidemic. And people die from the regular flu epidemics every year. We lose about 36,000 to 40,000 Americans every year from the flu. You never hear about that, though. But they have a lot of vaccines to sell, so they've got to push this one more. So, you know, the little deception game going on there. Not surprising, they've done this over and over and over. But we will have serious pestilences too, actual ones. And they'll affect us. They will affect the third world worse. Because they don't have medical capability that the Western world or the first world has, but I think an awful lot of it is they, in many cases, don't have right kind of nutrition or the education about nutrition like we have it. You know, the junk food junkies of the universe. These are the beginning of sorrows. Then there will be persecution in verse 9. Let's go back to this famines, pestilences, earthquake scenario again. Let me show you another prophecy before we come back to this line we're reading. It's in verse 20. It talks about those who are faithful will at some point have to flee. Go from where they are to where God wants them to be. And we certainly pray that we will be a part of that. But why, in verse 20, should we pray that your flight may not be in winter or on the Sabbath? Well, it's cold in the winter, and in times of stress, you need your rest. And the Sabbath is the day of rest, physically as well as spiritually. Right now, we have this great guffaw about global warming versus global cooling. And believe me, we've got something coming up in Copenhagen, and it's not snuff. It's a lot worse than that. It's a big conference that's going to be taking place about global warming and carbon footprints and all that stuff. It is designed to set up a supranational agency, national agency, eventually be part of the UN, that can go into America or into any other country and tax people because their carbon footprint is too big. And it's designed specifically, those who have studied it, so this is what it's designed to do, is to suck wealth out of particularly America, we're the target, and give it to the countries that are, you know, in serious straits, the third world countries. My question is, who's doing the sucking of the wealth, and who's doing the giving? You know, I don't think it's going to get past that spot. Yeah, that's human nature. And it's all in the frantic hurry to stop global warming. We don't know if we can. We don't know how much we actually heat the globe up based on the history of the planet. We can't do that. We can wreck our air and foul our rivers and kill our harbors and poison our fisheries. We can do that. We can make deserts by mowing down trees and never planting them back like idiots. That's the Sahara Desert. Thank the Romans for that. The Sahara Desert used to be their granary. North Africa used to be the breadbasket of Europe. But the Romans had this habit of mowing down trees and never planting them back, which is why Israel is such an arid nation. They did it there too. The Israelis came back and started planting trees immediately back when they got a hold of the country, and so the climate has moderated a little bit there. But can we heat the globe up to the degree that the global warming people say? The science is out. In fact, there's an awful lot of science that says that these guys are spinning a yarn and that they're deceiving again because it's power. It's a power grab is what this Copenhagen conference is going to be. And it's going to make things, you know, if we're worried about our economy struggling and gasping along, it's going to be even harder by far if that goes through. We'll have to see what happens. But there is evidence, and even the normally liberal National Geographic magazine reported it, that we are entering a period of the solar minimum. And that means for a few decades, we go down to where the sun has almost no solar storms, no sunspots. And we think, oh, great, I won't mess up my cell phone and interfere with radio reception like anybody listens to radio these days, at least out in this part of the country. But there's something else that happens in a solar minimum. It gets colder. When the sun has solar storms, it gets hotter. When it goes into a minimum, that's a solar maximum, when it goes into a minimum phase, it gets colder, and it's been doing that. We've been studying that cycle, but the global warming people don't want to tell you that we just went into a global minimum or solar minimum. National Geographic actually admitted it two issues ago. And of course, this has nothing to do, we don't think, maybe, hopefully not, with global warming. That's still happening, but it's going to get colder. You see what I mean on the deception end of things? Now, let me ask you this. We're talking about famines and pestilence. We're talking about don't desire to flee when the time comes to run for your life. Pray that it is not in the winter. Well, if you have global warming, you're not going to have much of a winter about anywhere. You know, all the ice is going to melt, and people on the seashore, yeah, they're going to have tough times. The shore is going to be inland. But what's that going to do to food production? Reduce it? Let me ask you this. How much food do they grow on the beach? Nixish in German. Nothing. But if you had global warming, you could increase your growing season dramatically in Canada, in northern Russia, and all of those marginal Arctic tundra territories. You could suddenly have cropland that extended to the Arctic Circle. You could generate more food than you can imagine. And then you'd be able to help feed the people who had to, you know, swim for their lives and go to high ground on the coasts. And you could settle them up there, let them farm. Canada, I know they always wanted to move to Canada. They hate living on the beach. Well, stop and think about it. What if it in fact is that we're looking at global cooling? What if, on the other hand, instead of extending the growing season in the north, it shortens? What if it starts knocking out Saskatchewan's fields and Alberta's fields and Manitoba's fields and Ontario's fields? What if we don't have Canadian grain and northern Russian grain being fed into the system because it's getting colder? What if it gets so cold that we can't grow on the northern tier of American states corn and soybeans and things that we traditionally have because we have a long enough growing season? Ooh. Then the super wall might be only full of Chinese cloth made into clothing-like things and nothing to eat unless you can eat polyester. You know, it could be a lot worse, a lot quicker if it's not global warming, but in fact is global cooling, which is what a lot of scientists are saying is actually happening. They don't know if it's going to be that dramatic of global cooling, but they do know it'll happen. I'll give you a quick idea. You know, they're terrified that glaciers will melt. 1943, a squadron of fighter airplanes and bombers were flying from Nova Scotia to England, to World War II, to be used in the war effort. They got stopped by a big storm just off of Greenland, so they doubled back. And it was a bad storm, so they had to go down. There was an outpost base. They landed there. Basically, it was a runway. And then the crews, managed to get down safely enough. And then they and the men at the base headed south because the storm was fierce. And they got out, but those planes got buried in the snow. And then they got buried in ice. And it was in the 1980s that somebody went looking for them because they think the war effort is make more planes, you know. Don't worry about that. We get more of them shot down than we said in that squadron every day. So they found them in the 1980s, thanks to National Geographic. We know the details because they did a big article on it. And they invented a machine that would melt the ice in a 5-foot circle and pump out the hot water through the middle and back up onto the top. And they bored down through the glacial ice to get to where those planes were. And they excavated the planes. It was ice archaeology. They brought them out piece by piece because there weren't many of those planes left. You know how deep they were? 260 feet. Whoa, just a minute. Now, that's impossible. You can't build glaciers in 40 years that are 200 plus feet deep. Well, I don't know. Somebody did. Because they had to bore through it to get to where the planes were. Well, then that means that had global warming in the 1940s. Yeah, you betcha. It was just ending then. Which is why that storm, you know, locked those planes on the ground and then buried them in the snow and then buried them in the ice and so on and so on and so on. You see, you're not getting the total story from the so-called experts. There's more to this issue than not, and global cooling would be more devastating, I think, by far than global warming. And we're looking at devastation. That's what we need to worry about. Now, back in Matthew 24, off our digression, we pick right up where we are. Verse 9 talks about persecution for those who believe and know the truth of God. And then many will be offended. Notice that in America, one of the greatest traits of True sensitivity is to be offended. In the Bible, that is a derogatory term. You're offended? You shouldn't be offended. Great peace have they who love your law. Nothing shall offend them. Irritate them, anger them, shock them perhaps, but not offend them. But in our culture, being offended is a badge of honor. No, it's not a badge of honor. It's a badge of immaturity. And gullibility, because you don't understand human nature. And they will betray one another and hate one another. We see that at the family level. We see that at the so-called friendship level. We see that in, you know, the community level and every which where. And then many false prophets will arise and deceive many. And we got more religious persecution, or deception, I'm sorry, more religious deception. And then verse 12, and then lawlessness, because lawlessness will abound. The love of many will wax cold, all except for the love that we mentioned back in 2 Timothy 3, which is the love of self. That doesn't seem to wax cold at all. But he who endures to the end shall be saved. Ah. Now we're getting an inkling of what to do. Endure. Stand fast. And this gospel of the kingdom will be preached in all the nations as a witness to, and then the end will come. So we have to preach the gospel and endure. That's our marching orders. But how do we do that? I think we need wisdom, we need guidance, and certainly in a dangerous era, we need protection. So, let's look at wisdom in Proverbs chapter 1. Our three things that need to be a focus for our prayers. Instead of asking for stuff, ask for wisdom and guidance and protection. Proverbs 1, we're looking at the introduction to the book of Proverbs, and I'm going to give you a couple of Hebrew words, actually three. This is under the point of praying for wisdom. Proverbs of Solomon, son of David, king of Israel. Verse 2. To know wisdom and instruction. Okay, this wisdom is the wisdom that is used primarily in the book of Proverbs. It is the primary word for wisdom. There's a secondary word we'll get to in a minute, but this is the primary word. In Hebrew, it's chachma. English letters, C-H-O-C-H-M-A-H. C-H-O-C-H-M-A-H. Chachma, chachma. That's how they say it in Hebrew. The definition. The definition by Amos Moses Maimonides, who was one of the leading rabbis of the 1100s A.D., probably the leading rabbi in the known world, his definition was, it is the knowledge of those truths which lead to the knowledge of God. And I think, so, okay. What does that mean? You know God's way. Well, yeah, that's pretty much what it is. But there's more to understanding. We have access, brethren, to a wisdom that the rest of mankind just doesn't even think about. It's right there on our lap. We take the Bible seriously. And we understand what the story of the Bible is and what God is doing. And we understand Jacob's trouble because we know who Jacob is today. And lots of other things. All right. I have a commentary. This is a Jewish commentary, but they provide some added insight on the word, being it's a Hebrew word. It is not sagacity. Sagacity is highfalutin thinking, basically. It's not abstract learning, and it's not philosophical speculation. That's not what wisdom is. Wisdom is practical. You can put it to work. They have another sentence that helps describe the value of it. Wisdom, this wisdom, chachma, is an understanding of the principles which control and direct human living at its highest and best. Knowing how to live God's way correctly. That's what it is. When you combine it with instruction, notice it says, to know wisdom and instruction. This is the purpose of the wisdom literature of the Bible, and specifically the purpose of the Proverbs. To know wisdom and instruction. You combine it with the word for instruction, where the Hebrew for that is musar, M-U-S-A-R, which is teaches how self-discipline may be exercised. When you combine wisdom and instruction together, you have essentially true ethics and moral philosophy. Not the meandering philosophy that philosophy students study, but moral philosophy, the way of thinking about God's way of life. I summarized it once in studying that commentary and studying the subject of wisdom. Wisdom is the way of life. God's wisdom is practical and pragmatic. Simply applying God's way of life. The word chokhmah carries with it a sense of practical skill. Not just this, you know, wispy, fancy-dancy mental meandering, but actual practical skill and ability and craftsmanship. Let me give you an example. Back in the book of Exodus, there's a man named Bezalel. B-E-Z-A-L-E-L. And Bezalel, or Bezaleel, sometimes it's said, was given chokhmah. He was given wisdom. Specifically says that he was given wisdom in working with metal and wood and gems and all manner of building, because he was the contractor that put the tabernacle together. The portable temple of God was Bezalel. And God gave him specific wisdom, skills in all these things. So you can see that the concept of the word means practical divine skill. Skill in living, in other words. Skill in living the right way. That's what we want to ask for. We need to ask God to give us the wisdom so we can have skill in living God's way. The first skill is to know that we obey God and we live God's way. And then secondly, to go into deeper than that, you get the study of wisdom of how to be the wiser than just basic wisdom, but go on to deeper levels of wisdom. Let's look at the next word. It's in verse 3. Again, the purpose is to receive the instruction of wisdom. The instruction or discipline of wisdom. Now, that wisdom is a different word in verse 3. It comes from the Hebrew word Haskel. In English letters, H-A-S-K-E-L. Haskel. It means wise dealing, is the way it's rendered in the Revised Standard Version. Perhaps the way it would be understood best in our language today is insight. A savvy, an insight, a practical sense of something. The commentary that I cited, the Sonsino, says about it, it says, the reader will be taught how to acquire the discipline which will enable him to perceive the line of conduct that is just and right. And it's the reasoning ability to come to the conclusion of what should be done. What's just and what's right, because that's what should be done. What's wrong should not be done. It carries with it the concept of being circumspect, skillful, again, skillful in the practical sense, and intelligent. It is much like Haskel is the applied skill that is used by an artist or a musician. It's very similar in some ways to chokhmah, but it is the applied skill. In other words, wisdom affects living much the same way that the skills of artists affect their craft. I was listening to the news and on the national or PBS coming across, or what is it, NPR, that's what it is, on the radio. And I turned it on because I knew it was news time, and I heard this raucous rock music, and I thought, oh man, that station should be coming in clear. I'm getting all this static and white noise. And then I realized, oh no, that's the way the song was recorded. It's like you dumped a half of 55-gallon barrel full of broken glass, and you just shake the barrel and then record that. Shaking is sort of a generally rhythmic way, and I think a lot of that genre music down through the decades, they do that because they don't have a clue on actually how to play those instruments. So they just make scratchy noise. And then they got enough suckers who will buy the thing and think it's actual music. Their money rolls in and they don't care. Now, thankfully, there are a few real musicians that actually work on some of those bands. And so some songs actually do have a tune to them. And pity they don't let you hear it. But you know how a musician can... Let's take an example. Guitar, because we're talking about rock, and they play guitars. All right. You listen to the way so many of them make that scratchy noise. And then you go to somebody like Chet Atkins, the late Chet Atkins, I think. marvelous guitarist. He makes the guitar talk to you. And he doesn't play the scratchy sounds. He was an acoustics man. And I think Roy Clark is still alive, another recording artist. Roy Clark plays the electric guitar. It's similar to the lead guitars in rock and roll bands and country bands. They all the same guitar, basically. But he plays it, and he can make a thing talk to you. He just has a marvelous ability, the way his hands can run up and down the neck of the guitar, and he can strum the strings. Quite amazing. If you could live your life as well as either one of them can play the guitar, we'd be pretty happy all the time. You see, they had to apply themselves to develop that skill. We need the wisdom of Haskell so we can apply the skill to live. Now, there's one final one, and this bridges from wisdom over to guidance. It's in verse 5. A wise man will hear and increase in learning, and a man of understanding will attain wise counsel. The wise counsel, those two words, come from the Hebrew word tachbulah. It's an interesting one, T-A-C-H-B-U-L-A-H. T-A-C-H-B-U-L-A-H, tachbulah. Translated in some translation is wise steerings. And the reason is because it's connected to the Hebrew word for sailor. It literally means steerings. Hence, the discernment to steer a right course through life. I don't know how many of you have sailed. I mean, on a sailing ship without a motor, where you depended on the wind to move you. Did you know that you can sail into the wind? You have to be able to, because otherwise you could go across the ocean one way and you'd be stuck. You know, you just have to go around the world every time you went anywhere, just follow the wind. No, you sail against the wind. And you know what they call sailing against the wind? They do a zigzag course, moving their sails to where they pick the wind up at an angle, but it actually pushes the ship into the wind. Not directly into the wind, mind you. They're not stupid. They're going angling into the wind, and they get over here a ways, and then they make a course correction, and they throw their sails around the other way, and they angle that way, and they zigzag directly into the wind, and that's called tacking. Tachbulah. See, the Hebrew word is, for we get the word tack in sailing, comes from this Hebrew word right here. So it means steering into the wind. Now, we have to fly into the wind of a lot of stuff that's coming down upon us in this age. We need this kind of wisdom. We need to pray, in summary, for the wisdom part, we need to pray for God's wisdom to make wise and right decisions in our lives, to avoid dangerous areas, to be frugal and thrifty and budget. You know, we're in economic tough times, and they're likely to get worse. We need to be very, very thrifty and frugal in that way, much more than we have been. We need to be absolutely truthful. Don't deal in lies. That's what the world does. Deception is their game. It's not our game. We need to avoid sinful entertainment. Those are just a few of things, the things that come to mind. But you can make a long list of what you need to pray for wisdom to do. Become a good part of a prayer strategy. Now, when you stop and think about wise steerings, we're asking God to give us wisdom so we can steer our lives wisely. But there are forces that can come against us that we can't see. And thus, we need God to guide the steerings. We need God's guidance. So we pray for wisdom and for guidance. Let's go to Psalm 78. We need God's guidance. That's what our two archers, and they were prayed for guidance when they wanted to find that bull moose. Amen. You know, I think God answered their prayers. Psalm 78. A lot of the Psalms are a lot like the Proverbs. Some of the Psalms have other messages, but they all have great wisdom within them and a wisdom of understanding God's guidance. Psalm 78, verse 52. But he made his... This is talking about taking Israel out of Egypt in verse 51, destroyed the firstborn of Egypt and so on. And he made his own people, in verse 52, to go forth like sheep and guided them in the wilderness like a flock. And God did. He guided them where He wanted them to go, where they needed to go. And with that guidance itself came a level of protection. In verse 53, He led them on safely so that they did not fear, but the sea overwhelmed their enemies. That's talking about the Exodus, crossing the Red Sea, and then it talks about going on into the wilderness. God guided the Israelites. Now, it says that He guided them like, He sent them out like sheep and guided them in the wilderness like a flock. Well, who is it that guides a flock of sheep? It's a shepherd. Psalm 23 then talks about God's guidance. And maybe we haven't always thought of Psalm 23 like that. We usually can recite that because if we learned anything in the Bible, this was one part we did learn. And as far as memory went in the past, before we came to know God's truth, then we found out we just needed to memorize the whole Bible and got a little overwhelmed. Should memorize bits and pieces, though. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. That means I shall not lack. It's the old English usage of the word want, to want. He makes me to lie down in green pastures. You know, He guides the flock to the green pastures. He leads me beside the still waters. He guides them to the where the water is. He restores my soul, leads me in the paths of righteousness for His name's sake. And yea, though I walk in the valley of the shadow of death, I'll fear no evil, for You're with me. Your rod and Your staff, they comfort me. God guides, and that guidance protects us. Provides for us and protects us. And this is beyond our ability to make wise decisions. We need God's direction. But it does require our involvement. In Proverbs chapter 3, here's another one that you probably memorized when you did come into the church. Chapter 3 and verse 5 and 6. This is a huge point of wisdom. Trust in the Eternal with all your heart. And lead not on your own understanding. You know, you go to God for guidance. In all your ways, acknowledge Him, and He will direct or guide your paths. So we need to pray for that guidance. God will guide us through the economic tough times, through the times of Jacob's trouble, through all the perilous times we live in. We need direction and guidance in there. Let's go to another fascinating yet slightly obscure passage in Isaiah. It's chapter 28 of Isaiah. Verse 23 to 29 of Isaiah 28. Essentially, the message here is listen to the teaching of God. Listen to the teaching of God. You'll see how it ties into guidance in a moment. Give ear and hear my voice. Listen and hear my speech. God is speaking to mankind, to Israel specifically, to us, spiritual Israel, but to mankind. Does the plowman keep plowing all day to sow? Does he keep turning his soil and breaking the clods? Does he? If you shake your head like this, you're right. No, he finishes plowing and then he's done with the plowing. He doesn't just keep plowing and plowing and plowing. Nothing could grow if he kept doing that. Because you'd bury the seeds too deep and they wouldn't germinate. When he has leveled its surface, does he not sow black cumin? So he gets the surface done, he plants the seed. In this case, black cumin. Cumin is a spice. And scatter the cumin and plant the wheat and rows and the barley in its appointed place and the spelt in its place. Spelt is like wheat, only different. For he instructs him in right judgments. See, God instructs the planter. He knows he doesn't just plow forever. He gets the soil ready, gets it leveled out, and then he puts in the seeds, some cumin and some wheat and some spelt and the barley. It all goes into its place. God instructs him in right judgment. His God teaches him. And so God teaches us how to grow things. More those who are involved in growing things than others, but we also understand that he teaches us how to grow spiritually in an application in that principle. For the black cumin is not, verse 27, it is not threshed with a threshing sledge, nor is a cartwheel rolled over the cumin, but the black cumin is beaten out with a stick and the cumin with a rod. Ah, so it's harvested differently. It's not harvested like the wheat and the other things. The cumin is probably a finer little seed. So you'd lose it if you did it, harvested it in the regular way that you harvest the larger grains. But the farmer knows that. That's how you harvest the cumin. Red flour, however, must be ground. Therefore, he does not thresh it forever. And you get the wheat or the spelt or the barley and you're going to make flour to make bread. You grind it. You don't stand there threshing and threshing and threshing. I mean, the way they thresh, by the way, is they would drive their cattle around and around, one of the oxen, breaking the wheat berries out of the wheat. And then that would be put into a big basket, a big shallow basket like this. And they would stand on hilltops. That's why they did it. And they'd toss it in the air, and the chaff, which is lightweight, would blow away. And they'd catch the grain. And they'd stand there and toss it. Now, if you were threshing wheat so that you're going to make bread later when you grind it, are you going to throw it forever? Are you going to do that all day long, or are you going to do it until the wheat's clean? Well, if you're a farmer, you'll know, okay, that wheat's clean. I'll dump that and go get some more. Bread flour must be ground. Therefore, he doesn't thresh it forever. He doesn't break it with his cartwheel, because it's not the way you grind it, or crush it with his horseman. This also comes from the Lord of hosts. See, God gives people the guidance and the wisdom to know how to grow things. This all comes from the Lord of hosts, who is wonderful in counsel and excellent in guidance. And we need God's guidance. He's excellent in guidance. Winston Churchill used to say, particularly of the war years, "I have a great feeling of interference." That at times when decisions were being made and events were suddenly happening in World War II, he had this feeling of interference. He meant divine interference, that God was intervening in some way. And indeed, we want that interference in our lives, where we don't know what's coming. We don't know where the grizzly bear is in the brush. We want God to guide us away from him and toward the moose. You can eat moose. It's hard to eat a bear. They're unclean. Then we need to pray for protection. And this is more self-explanatory, I guess, but it still needs to be done. We go back to Proverbs chapter 3, where we were. Proverbs chapter 3, begins in verse 19. "The Lord by wisdom founded the earth. By understanding he established the heavens." I mean, God made everything. He is the great creator. "By his knowledge the depths were broken up and the clouds dropped down the dew. My son, let them not depart from your eyes," this knowledge of God and his wisdom. "Keep sound wisdom and discretion, so they will be life to your soul and grace to your neck, and you will walk safely in your way." Having better wisdom, God's wisdom in our minds, makes us safer to begin with. Having his guidance makes us safer still. "And your foot will not stumble. And when you lie down, you'll not be afraid. Yes, you'll lie down and your sleep will be sweet. Do not be afraid of sudden terror, nor of trouble from the wicked when it comes. For the Lord will be your confidence and will keep your foot from being caught." God stands as our protection. Psalm 18, one of David's psalms. We'll pick it up in verse 30 of Psalm 18. "As for the Lord, his way is perfect. The word of the Lord is proven." This is verse 30 of Psalm 18. "He is a shield to all who trust in him." He shields, he protects us. "For who is God except the Lord? And who is a rock except our God? It is God who arms me with strength and makes my way perfect. He makes my feet like the feet of a deer and sets me in high places. Teaches my hands to make war so that my arms can bend a bow of bronze." And I do not know what that is. A couple of us have speculated on a bow of bronze. You can make bows out of steel, but I don't know that you can make spring bronze. Spring steel makes a bow. The powerful crossbows of yesteryear, 1,200 pounders, were made out of, that's not how much they weighed, not how much they pulled. They were made out of steel. So a bow of bronze to me is baffling, unless, in fact, in David's day, somebody knew how to make steel. And then it was called bronze, but it was actually more of a steel than a bronze. But in other words, the bottom line of this little passage is that God is our shield. He protects us, strengthens us, guides us, watches over us. And He desires to protect us. Psalm 91. Well, we have to ask Him for that protection, and we know that we need it, and that was the reason for going through the prophecies of our age at the beginning. He who dwells, this is Psalm 91, talking about God, who dwells in the secret place, the Most High, shall abide under the shadow of the Almighty. I will say to my God, or to the Lord, He is my refuge and my fortress, my God, in Him I will trust. This is, again, realizing that God is our protector. Surely He shall deliver you from the snare of the fowler and the perilous pestilence, verse 3. And He will uncover your, He will cover you with His feathers, as it were, and under His wings you will take refuge like a little chicken. And your truth, His truth rather, will be your shield and buckler. So God protects. Now, the application of these things. There is a prayer that was prayed in Acts chapter 4, right after the church began. Peter and John and some of the apostles had been arrested for preaching in the name of Jesus Christ of Nazareth by the Jewish authorities, who didn't want them doing that. When they were released, they came back and they all prayed this prayer. This prayer is a prayer for wisdom and guidance and protection so that they could continue to bring the gospel to the world. So when they heard that, they raised their voice in verse 24 with one accord and said, Lord, so here's the prayer, Lord, You are God who made heaven and earth and the sea and all that is in them, and who by the mouth of Your servant David has said, why do the nations rage and the people plot vain things? The kings of the earth took their stand, and the rulers were gathered together against the Lord and against His Christ, or the Messiah. For truly, against Your holy servant Jesus, whom You anointed, both Herod and Pontius Pilate, and the Gentiles and the people of Israel were gathered together to do whatever Your hand and Your purpose determined for to be done. The Christ died for the sins of mankind. That had to be done. Now we get to the prayer for the church. Now, Lord, look on their threats and grant Your servants that with all boldness they may speak Your word. Protect us from their threats and give us boldness by stretching out Your hand to heal, that signs and wonders may be done through the name of Your holy servant Jesus. So they ask that God would protect them and give them boldness, which has to do with wisdom, and that He would give them guidance through the signs and wonders that the apostles did, which drew the attention of the population to hear the message of the coming of the kingdom of God. This is just one example how for the church and the work that we have to do, we can pray for wisdom and guidance and protection. But it also gives us a little bit of a mold so that we can look in our own lives and the trials and the tests that we face in the days ahead, that we, instead of asking for things and for stuff, can ask for God's wisdom, His guidance, and His protection.